record then. Okay, so recording is on. It would have been nice if you could probably just introduce yourself. And maybe just give me probably 30 seconds per person, or 30 seconds per person, but just briefly mention your background. Okay. Maybe which part of the country you are in.
My name is Margaret.
Yes.
I studied computer science and I'm living in Abuja.
Okay, where did you study your computer science?
University of Lagos.
Okay, UNILAG.
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's fine. I was there last year actually as a visiting scholar. Okay, so thank you. You're welcome. Next person.
My name is Emmanuel Kiunga. I'm from Tanzania. I did a Bachelor of Science in Information Technology at the Institute of Finance Management in Dar es Salaam.
Okay, but that's not DIT, right?
No, I did the information technology.
Yes, but it wasn't at the Dar es Salaam Institute of Technology.
No. It's the Institute of Finance Management.
Okay, because I have some friends from DIT as well as the university in Arusha, I believe. Yeah. Okay, you're welcome.
Okay.
I believe you are on campus right now.
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's fine. Next.
So my name is Victor Solomon.
Okay.
I studied computer science from Kaduna State University. Okay. And I live in Kaduna State.
Okay, KD. Okay, in the Kaduna City or...
Oh, yes, Cardinal. Parts.
Okay. That's fine.
The capital of Cardinal State.
Okay. Nice to meet you. Next.
Issa Hawa. I had my first degree in. From Bayero University. I'm a Nigerian.
Okay. BUK.
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's nice. Okay, pleased to meet you. I did have some friends with at BUK. Galadanchi and a few other people. But that's a long time ago, I believe. Okay, so next.
Good morning. My name is Shamaka Mary. I study computer science at Godfrey Okoye University.
Okay.
I live in Abuja.
Okay, Godfrey Okoye appears to be one of the private universities, right? Or am I wrong?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Hannah Tubelo Bavuto from Davis. I studied computer science from Federal University.
Sorry, I didn't get where you said Federal University.
Uninke.
Okay. Okay, welcome. Next.
My name is Efiong Blessing. I studied computer science at the University of Nigeria, Nsukka.
Okay, UNN. Okay. So there are two blessings in the class.
Yes, sir.
Okay, have you guys worked out any signaling system? Is it blessing one, blessing two?
Sir, our surnames are just okay.
Okay. Okay, so surname is the standard way of reaching out to people. Okay. Okay, next, please.
My name is Blessing Ogbe. I studied mathematics at the University of Jos, Nigeria.
Okay, interesting. Maths, University of Jos. Okay, I have lots of friends from UniJos. Professor Liverpool, did you ever meet him? I guess no. Hello.
Yeah.
I was asking if you ever knew a Professor Liverpool.
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay, okay.
That's before he retired.
Yeah, he's a good friend of mine. I visited Joss quite a few times over the years. I still do a lot of work with the IT department in Joss as well.
Okay.
Okay, next.
Ibrahim. Hello, good morning, sir.
Good morning.
My name is Omar Ibrahim. I studied computer science at Federal University Dutse in Jigawa State.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay, okay. Pleased to meet you.
You too, sir. Thank you.
I believe that's all. There appears to be one more person on the list, or am I wrong? Okay, okay, so I think we got everyone. Okay. Okay, so you are all welcome to the class, and as requested, I will enable my video, but if there's any problem with bandwidth at any time on the part of anyone, you can simply type a chat, let me know, okay? So I will also start by introducing myself as well. I hope everyone has a copy of the presentation now. I'm going to sort of work on the assumption that you do. If not, you'll probably still get it by the end of the class. So if you see me every now and then looking sideways, it's because I have another screen where I'm trying to make sure to confirm what I expect you should be receiving. Okay, so the basic idea, I believe, is to have classes from 9 until 12, so about 3 hours each day. Yeah. I do feel this is heavy if it's just going to be one-sided. So as much as possible, I'll expect us to interact. Okay, so it's not going to be a one-sided presentation. So this is an MSc level course, I believe, but I think it's also interesting, even if you are not immediately at the MSc level. So the first slide is just an introduction of who I am. I obtained my PhD from the University of Ulster in Northern Ireland, UK. My BSc and MSc were from the Obafemi Awolowo University in Ileife, Nigeria. So as you probably may have guessed, I'm also a Nigerian. Okay. I moved to the ICTP quite a while ago, and I work in the IT department where some of my duties cover high performance computing and several other things. So over the years, I've also supervised students both at MSc and PhD levels from various institutions worldwide. This is one of the benefits of being at an institution like the ICTP. The ICTP, I hope if you, is short for the International Center for Theoretical Physics. And it's located in the north eastern part of Italy. It's a really interesting place to work because it acts like a melting pot for scientists and researchers from all parts of the world. We typically tend to have several Nobel laureates or international prize winners showing up on campus. Maybe I will say at least two Nobel laureates every year, something like that. But the thing is, here the atmosphere is really cordial, and most times you're on a first name basis with everyone. And there's not a there's not a lot of protocol. So it doesn't matter whether you've won a Nobel Prize or not. It's still just a very relaxed, laid back atmosphere. Over the years, I think one of my early work was developing an internet gateway as far back as 1999. It was used heavily for accessing the internet at that time. And it was used quite a lot by people from Eastern Europe, US, and things like that, but not really Africa, you know. So, but subsequently, I've also worked on an e-learning framework, as well as developing HPC centers on the African continent, or in developing countries, not just Africa, because we've worked with growing HPC in Bangladesh, Ethiopia, Cameroon, Ivory Coast, Ghana, okay, and several locations in Nigeria. So I can give you a pretty good idea of where the various HPC installations are in Nigeria. And also in Tanzania, we did do some work with Tanzania. And incidentally, HPC-wise, I'm also a consultant or a resource person for SADC, which is the Southern African Development Community, where I work hand-in-hand with the only supercomputing center on the African continent, which is located in South Africa. But part of our efforts and activities cover countries like Botswana, and also an installation in Tanzania at the Dar es Salaam Institute of Technology, and other countries that are Zimbabwe and places like that. So currently I'm a staff of the IT department. I run the infrastructure unit here. And I also work with the ITU Center of Excellence on IoT, Big Data and Statistics. My PhD work was on the field of augmented reality. So I still continue to work with the laboratory or research with the laboratory where I developed that from. Then in the last few years, I've also been working with international organizations like the CoData and the Research Data Alliance on various issues related to data science, machine learning, and artificial intelligence. Okay, so I have a long list of research interests because my BSc and MSc were in, so my BSc was in electronic and electrical engineering. My MSc was a bridge between computer science and engineering. And then my PhD was in computing. So I seem to cover topics in various areas there, or I have covered topics in various areas there. Okay, so we're not really here to talk about me. For the class, what I believe or how I think we will structure it, I hope it works out well, is that we're going to do like 50-60% lectures, and there'll be extensive opportunities for hands-on sessions. And when I mean hands-on, I will probably have expected people to be able to contribute either by voice, or maybe we can see how it goes with just chats. And then my plan is also to have people do some hands-on work on the HPC cluster located in the AUSD campus there. I think since I cannot see your face, I cannot really tell whether you are getting bored by what I'm saying, or you are you've left the computer screen, but I expect you to have self-motivation with respect to this particular course. And in order to sort of encourage you in that direction, I will probably request that each one of you should write down your expectations, okay, for this course, and simply just send me an email. You'll find my email address at the beginning of the presentation here. Okay, so you write down your expectations, and then if you have some ideas about possible goals and targets, we can, you can also care to share that with me. Okay, so as a first exercise, I was going to have us jointly look at the course outline together. I hope you have all received that as well by email. Let me just bring that up. Oh, I forgot to mention that I'm also a visiting professor to the University of Ibadan, also at the Addis Ababa University as well. So, 06 AST course. Okay, can everyone see the, let's start from the beginning. So the outline basically provides a set of reference texts. I think this one's, you can see my highlights. This two by Victor Ejikut. Are available commercially, but I can probably send you PDF copies of the early versions of this. Just let me know if you really need them. Many of the other ones are available on the internet. Okay, but there's no hard and fast rule that you have to acquire anything. Okay. I will probably expect you to have some programming experience in C. So it would be nice if you've done programming in C language. If you've also had exposure to parallel programming, that would be useful. And maybe as we get along, working with things like matrices and some experience with linear algebra should also be useful. So it's not a very, as a course, let's say, or as a topic, high performance computing, or as a branch of computer science, high performance computing has not been around for so long. But we'll try to look at the foundations that started a long time ago, even as far back as the 40s, and gradually build up the expectation. The topics I hope to cover will be introduction and history. Then we'll look at tools, probably try to have some hands-on experience with tools for high-performance computing. We'll look at various issues and how to address them. And then maybe if we can, we'll do some exercises with trying to computerize various techniques and algorithms, especially in that are useful for scientific applications. I know this is a very ambitious list of goals. Let's see what we can achieve at the end of this online lectures. It will have been nicer if we had, a face-to-face class, or we were all together on AUST campus. If you have a question at any time, feel free to just jump in. Unfortunately, I'm not always looking at the chat, so you might need to maybe try and signal us by voice if you have a question at any point in time. Okay. So I will encourage everyone to sort of try and stay focused during the class and avoid side communication, okay, because I expect you to participate also in the classes. The good thing is there are only 9 of you, so it's not too bad. There will be probably a couple of homeworks every week, and I will expect that homeworks should have been submitted by Friday. Okay, the homeworks will involve some programming and maybe writing of short reports. There'll be a final examination, and this is how I expect the grades to be assigned. So coming to class punctually and participating in class discussions could fetch you up to 6 marks. Homeworks, if we get 2 of them per week, it means each week we are looking at about 8 marks. For homeworks and assignments. And then the final examination will carry about 70 marks. Schedule, what I hope to cover today is introduction to high performance computing, introduce you to concepts like parallelism, cluster infrastructure, architecture, and hopefully give you homework 1. Tomorrow, we hope to sort of introduce everyone to the HPC cluster at AUST, discuss the hardware component, how it is set up. And then if time and probably the energy corporation permits, we'll carry out hands-on exercises on where you practically log in and do 1 or 2 exercises on the cluster itself. That's subject to how NEPA will go. Okay, on Wednesday, we'll be looking at parallel implementation of some common mathematical algorithms, and then we'll get a second assignment. And then we'll probably end the day with looking at shell scripting and how you can compile source codes, C source codes, Fortran, or C++ source codes on the HPC cluster. Thursday, we'll look at how we can measure performance, how we can predict, and then carry out things like debugging. And then we'll do a review of everything we're supposed to have learned during the week. And then Friday, I will expect you to spend the 3 hours of Friday working on your own, completing your assignments, submitting the homeworks, as well as reviewing the things we did during the week. Second week, we are going to be looking at more soft sides of the software side of things. So we'll be looking at how memory is organized, how data is organized, the various programming models that are available, threads, semaphores, and then we'll get a homework as well. And then we'll look at programming in OpenMP, which is good for multi-core machines. And then probably work on hands-on for threads and OpenMP. And then we'll look at distributed memory programming, MPI, and things like that on Wednesday, to get the second assignment. And then we'll complete the week on Thursday, looking at how you can do MPI programming on the cluster. And Friday, as usual, is submitting assignments and revisions. The third week will focus more on what is called GPU programming. And then we'll look at various things we can do in that direction. Hopefully we might be able to do hands-on programming on the AUST cluster, as well as some hybrid programming models. And I hope on the Thursday of that week, we will have the final examination and probably a wrap-up session. Okay, we might have sort of like an hour before the exams, where you can ask questions and then things you might feel you still have problems with. And then on Friday, of course, will be a free day. Okay, are there any comments? Somebody said I'm not very audible. You can't hear me. Is that right? Is it better now? Can you hear me better? Okay, I will try to improve the audio volume. Okay, how is it now? Is it probably too much or it's better now? Okay, so you need to be responsive, otherwise I kind of get the feeling I'm talking to myself here.
For me, it's clear. I don't know about the...
Okay. Are there any questions or comments about the outline? Is everything okay? I hope nobody's worried about the pace. Feel free to also type. Yeah.
That is the exam. Will it be written exams?
Yes, it's going to be written exams.
Mm-hmm. Sorry? These were in different locations.
Yes, it will be written exams. You will have to either, I'm not sure how the procedure will be. There are two possibilities. One is I send you a Word document and you simply fill in your answers in the Word document and email it back. Okay, yeah. And the alternative is to say, okay, you write your answer on a piece of paper and you email me photographs of these pieces of paper. Okay. A third possibility is to sort of MCQ. Somebody was saying something. Yeah, somebody was saying not all of you have. Okay, I didn't get that. Not all of you have something, but it's okay. Okay. Yes. So I think we've completed this now. Is it okay if... okay, so I have an interesting comment here from Blessing, from Efyong. She would like to know if the hands-on require a laptop because she's working from the phone and she might not be able to participate fully in the hands-on in that regard. It would have been nice to be able to use a laptop or a desktop for the hands-on. It's possible to work using a tablet, but it's not as comfortable, especially if you have to type. Using a phone, okay, it's probably less convenient compared to a laptop. I wasn't expecting you to do any installation on your laptop, as the hope is that we'll be able to work with software that is on the AUSD cluster. But you need to have the tool for remote access. Either an SSH client, preferably an SSH client on your device. The notes will have covered SSH client for Windows, Linux, and Macintosh platforms. Probably I can also add a section for maybe Android or iOS devices. What SSH clients are available and how you can use them for remote access. Okay. So if there are no more comments or questions, I will just start with the introduction. If I'm moving too fast, just let me know. Okay. Or if there's something you feel we have to go over once again, let me know. I think with the Zoom client, it's also possible to signal by raising your hand, trying to raise your hand, apart from writing something in the chat. Okay, periodically, every now and then, I will go and review what is on the chat, but I don't have it directly in front of me. Okay, so Efyong has raised her hand. You want to say something, I believe?
So concerning the access to the AUSD, what did you call it again?
HPC.
The AUSD HPC cluster. Yeah, like if I can get like the SSM, like you can call it, because I'm searching on Play Store if I can get like a software that can help me to access it using my Android.
Yes,
would that
yes.
be feasible?
Yes, that's feasible. It's not going to be very convenient, but it should work as well. I actually have an SSH client already on my own Android device. So I can, in principle, send you a recommendation. But let's say we can also walk through this tomorrow as part of the class, because there'll be some time for you to get your devices sorted out and installed with the right application. Yeah?
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Okay, so I believe yes, that's fine. I will figure out the name of the client I'm supposed to have installed here on my machine. I can't readily see it on the list here. I mean, on my Android device. Okay. Okay, but it's also possible. I remember, yes, I think it was it last year? Yes, in UI, we had a hands-on session where somebody actually came to class with a tablet and he wanted to use the cluster or use a cluster from his tablet. Well, I think it's possible. Okay. Shall I move on? Okay, so for today's class, our basic overview is going to be, we'll look at a brief history of computers, and then we'll briefly also do some introduction to programming, just a very, very superficial introduction to programming in the C language, of course. And then we'll then move on to trying to define high-performance computing, and the role of high performance computing in science. And then we'll hopefully end up the day by looking at various hardware that can be used for HPC. Everything from mobile devices all the way to supercomputers. And then we'll start a bit of parallel programming as well. And finally end up with homework one. So just before we start, I just wanted us to have a quick warm-up exercise. So maybe we can do this quickly by also by sending your replies in the chat. So the question is, why do we use computers? What do you think? I'll expect to see people type responses on the chat. I'm going to update my own slides with your responses. So who is going to bail the cat? Okay, so we have Ogbe says to make work easier. Yeah. Please, if I didn't get this right. And then we have also, so I believe Margaret associates it. Okay, so we have also F. Young says for larger computing. For large computing. F. Young. Three, we have to make work more efficient. Efficient, this was Margaret. Right. And then we have four, to process large data. From Victor Solomon. Solomon, yeah. Okay, so let's take it a bit more personal now. I think these are all excellent suggestions. There is also a fifth one, faster computing. Faster computing from Huawei. Okay, so if we want to make it a bit more personal now, what do you use your computer or your computing device for? Of course, in this sense, we assume that your smartphone qualifies as a computing device. So this allows people with smartphones to also answer. What do you use your device for? Uh, It's also possible for multiple people to say that, I mean, to choose a specific line. Okay, so when you say networking, are you talking about human-to-human networking, or are you talking about computer networking? Okay, so both computer and human networking. So this is Sobe. Okay, so fast, easy multitasking of work schedule, information access for distribution. I think probably maybe information access might be okay. So let's say fast and easy access to information and work schedule. Am I right, Efyong? Okay, data collection and data analysis. Data collection and data analysis. And this is from Ibrahim. Is Ibrahim the last name or the first name? Okay, okay, last name, good. And then we have four.
Sir.
Okay.
Sorry, sir, I didn't see my reply.
Okay. So access information which helps in improving work performance. Sorry, I sort of missed that out. Yeah. So my apologies. So let's put that here, access. Information which helps in improving work, yeah, working performance. And this is from Emmanuel. Okay, I'm almost running out of page here. Okay, so I have data manipulation, and this is from Hannah 2-6. We have long distance communication. Okay, long distance communication, and I think it's fine. There'll be opportunity for people to contribute in other topics as we go along. So, but this is quite a very good list as well. Long distance communication. And 7. We have large accounting projects. Accounting projects from Mary and Igalo. Okay, Igwilo. Okay. So yeah, it's quite interesting. I think we get the basic idea. We can broadly classify some of these things into communication. So we use our device for communication. And this we can see for this particular one, as well as item 6. Okay, accessing information related to work and probably even leisure. Okay, so we see those here, here, and here. And then data collection, data analysis, and data manipulations. So working with data here and here. Okay. So we see a large accounting project. It would be nice to understand if Mary is an accountant or supporting some accounting software, or she has a particular software in mind. I think also, interestingly, we could in principle also add entertainment. So there are also people that use laptops for entertainment or leisure, right? Yes, so Huawa has added that to the list. Yeah, data manipulation. Let's say an entertainment. Okay, so entertainment will cover, of course, things like watching movies or playing games and things like that, which are good for relaxing. I should probably apologize in advance if this is information you know already. But a lot of what we sort of do in computing today, even the architecture, of course, of computers, was generally developed a long time ago, as far back as 1945, by a gentleman known as von Neumann. Okay, and the architecture he developed in 1945 is basically what we still use today for computers. The very early computers before 1945 tend to be programmed only to run a specific application. So the computer was built with the application already as part of it. And once that application or once that problem was solved, that computer was essentially useless. So you had to sort of build a new computer to solve a new problem or a new challenge that arose. And so von Neumann is credited with being the first person to propose that we can have changeable programs and that are executed sequentially. So the storing of programs, the sequential execution, and the fact that you can have a general purpose computer simply by changing the program, it will adapt its task or the problem it was designed to solve. Incidentally, if you look at his history, he was a mathematician, or he started life as a mathematician, but he made a lot of important contributions to the field of computing. So let's look at what he basically proposed. The main parts of the microprocessor came from the design provided by von Neumann. So he looked at several critical areas. So you have a set of memory, which will be things like the register. I think you can see my mouse pointing at the registers here. And then you have some processing going on in what is known as the arithmetic logic unit. And then you have a program decoder, a counter, and a stack also as memory. And then of course there's a clock to try and keep everything in sync. And quite important is you have a bus. I believe these are parts of a computer that we may have encountered during our undergraduate days. Am I right?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Okay. Yes, sir. Okay, so that's fine. So the question is, in this particular architecture, this generalized architecture, can you immediately identify what could be bottlenecks? I mean, what could be bottlenecks to performance in an architecture like this? Possible bottlenecks to performance. You can, if anyone has any contribution, you can probably just write it in the chat. Yeah. Okay. I can probably just provide some answers. Maybe because you are not too familiar with this architecture or with this diagram, especially if maybe you didn't have a course. Okay, so we've had some answers. So Huawa says, Huawa says memory. So the memory could be a hindrance to performance. Okay, that's a very good answer. And then Ogbe says synchronization. And then we also have F. Young saying memory as well, but F. Young is more specific, says speed of memory access. Emmanuel also focuses on memory, if memory is not in line with other devices, and goes on to mention the rate of data transfer via the buses. So Emmanuel says bus, yeah. Okay, it will have been interesting to sort of listen a bit more to what each person has to say about this. Yes, memory can be a bottleneck to performance, but there are several aspects of memory. Apart from the speed, we also have the size of memory that could be problematic. And then synchronization, clocking. There's probably a limit to how fast you can synchronize things. So that's quite valid. And then the fact that we have a bus for transferring data in and out into the system could also result in some performance bottlenecks. Okay, that's very good. So coming to memory, I think this next slide sort of jumps on memory, and it sort of highlights the fact that we all seem to be thinking alike, but it also affects the buses as well. So we're probably familiar with this system of size, okay, as far as computing is concerned. So if you say a kilobyte, you're looking at 1024 bytes, a collection of 1024 bytes. Then a megabyte is 1024 squared bytes. We have gigabyte, terabyte, petabyte, exabyte, yodabyte, and zettabyte. Okay, so this specify how much data you can receive and send at once, as well as how fast you can process things, right? So for memory, we have some early computers that grew from just being able to handle kilobytes. Nowadays, we're talking of the RAM memory in gigabytes, okay? We are probably going to be able to see that as far as supercomputers are concerned, we are already looking at terabytes and exabytes. Okay, terabyte, petabytes, and exabytes. Maybe in the next future, we might be looking at computers that are able to process yottabytes of data or even zettabytes of data. But there's been a natural progression in trying to solve problems with size limitation in that respect. Okay, so I'm not sure, maybe we should just do this exercise, or if we should probably skip it. Yeah, I guess we can skip it in the interest of time. We might come back to it later. So let's now look at the software side of things. Okay, so on the software side, I believe most of us will have heard about something called assembly code. Okay, or machine language. We know that microprocessors typically do not speak English, and they represent everything as a sequence of bytes. Okay, so even the instructions to add numbers or to multiply numbers or to subtract or to move data from one memory location to the other, it's coded as a sequence of bytes. And that's typically the assembly code. Anyone who has seen assembly code or worked with assembly code will realize that it's not very human friendly. So we tend to program computers in some language or languages that are really more friendly to human beings. Over the years, we've had several languages that are interpreted, okay? And I think a good example is the Python that you might be familiar with, is the Python programming language. It's an interpreted language, and this means that typically there's a program in between your program that you have written and the processor. So the job of that program is to take the instructions that you provide in the Python syntax and translate it into machine code or assembly code that is sent to the processor for execution. And then at the other end, we have some programs, some languages that you don't feed, you write in those languages, but you don't feed them to the computer. You instead translate that program into executable code. And then you then execute this executable code on the computer platform. And so there's no middleman in between. And languages like Fortran, C, C++, C Sharp, I guess you might also add Visual Basic and things like that. Most of the other languages you might have come across, Pascal and things like that, tend to fall into this area. A notable exception is the language called Java, which is heavily taught in many of our undergraduate programs in computer science. Java is considered semi-compiled. What does that mean? It means that Java simply, when you write a Java application, you write in syntax that is friendly to us human beings. But then after that, you need to sort of compile it into something they call bytecode, Java bytecode. And this is a sequence of instructions in a special notation that is interpreted by Java when you... So whenever you are going to execute it, you need an interpreter. The Java interpreter has to run, but it interprets the bytecode into machine code for the platform you are targeting. Why was this performed? It was really in the interest of portability. So the idea is that you can write your program in Java and have it work on different operating systems, different platforms. So your code could run on a refrigerator, it could run on your desktop computer, it could run on your mobile device as the same application. If you write it well, it's portable to different platforms. You only need to change the interpreter bit of it. So the interpreter on the platform will take care of mapping the bytecode to the right instructions for that particular hardware. And I think that's one of the key attractions of Java as a programming language. So the question here is that, do you see any problems with performance with programming languages? Is there any contributions or any comments from the class?
Yes, sir. In my view, there might be the effect of performance, which is related to the kind of programming language used to program some of the program. Because what I know, there are some programming languages, they use a lot of memory. So this, it means that when you are running those programs, they consume that memory. So there are some activities, they have to wait for those programs to execute first, then release the memory to other program to work. That is what I understand.
Okay, so from Emmanuel, thank you very much for that very interesting contribution. So Emmanuel says there's issues with memory. So some programming languages tend to consume more memory than others, and this tends to affect the performance of the software code that is being executed. Yes, that's very correct. Is there any other additional contribution?
So I think from
that, the closer the language is.
Okay, I guess somebody started and then another person jumped in. Maybe we can do one at a time, or you could also type. Yeah. So Margaret has raised her hand, so we can give Margaret the floor.
So I think some programming languages are better for a particular task. So if you use a wrong, like C# C is better in some to develop some programs. So if you use another programming language that may not be so good as C, it may affect the performance of the application.
Okay, so we have a very nice contribution from Margaret. So the idea is that your choice of language could affect performance because some languages perform better at one task compared to other languages. Okay, that's good. Victor, do you still have difficulty hearing? I mean, are you having difficulty hearing me or your classmates as well?
So it's a bit better now.
Okay, I think you're, yeah, I kind of get the idea that maybe you're on a very slow network connection, maybe a 3G. Let me do something. Maybe if I switch off my video, it might help. Yeah. I will need to stop sharing. Okay, and stop my video. And then I can resume sharing, and that should be fine. Okay, might be better now. Okay, yes. So do we have any other contribution from the class?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
So I feel like the closer the language is to the CPU, the faster it will take to execute us in terms of performance. Like okay. in for Python now, it requires it to be interpreted, and after interpretation, compilation, it's easier for the machine to understand, okay, this is my language in binaries, in bits. Like, it's really, really fast. But for other human-friendly languages, it takes time. That's in terms of time of execution.
Okay, thank you very much, Efyong. So if I sort of paraphrase your contribution for the class, it's like you feel assembly language will be fastest, followed by maybe compiled code, then before you are having semi-compiled and then interpreted. So if you can write your software in assembly language, or you write your application in assembly language, you are guaranteed the maximum speed. Yes. Okay. Thank you for the contribution. Yeah. Okay. I think that's quite important. And it's really what we were targeting with this slide here. The fact that you should understand that assembly language executes fastest. And then languages that are compiled are sort of in second place. So Fortran, C, C++, once you compile the executable, it's a collection of machine code as well. And then Java is in between compiled programs and interpreted programs. Okay, so Java, it's because it's semi-compiled, tends to fit in there. This is probably just a simplified view of the whole performance conundrum, simply because like our colleague mentioned earlier, if there's a challenge with memory, you find that languages like Java will tend to sort of perform even worse than Python, or an interpreted language like Python. Okay, but this is let's say discussion for another day. Yeah. Okay, so we move on to another aspect of programming. This is just probably a refresher about things we know already. So there are some applications that help you to create source code, that help you to modify program source code. And these tend to be called editors. So I don't know which editors are you familiar with. Maybe the class can provide. Okay, well, we'll do that at the end. And then in the case of can compile languages like Fortran, C++, C#, and so on and so forth, you also have compilers that look for maybe things like errors. They try to even do some little bit of optimization if necessary, just to try and make sure the program work well, but their main task is to take your text or take your human readable syntax and translate it into a sequence of machine code for execution on the CPU. And then you have the debuggers that help you to sort of walk through the program step by step, looking for errors. So in case the program is not producing the right output, a debugger is typically your friend to try and figure out why that's happening. And then very common nowadays are the integrated development environments. They tend to combine all the tools with editors, compilers, and debuggers into one interface. And then some people who've done serious programming will be familiar with revision control systems, like maybe Subversion, JIT, and so on and so forth. This is for helping you take note of which changes as you make to the code, because typically programming it sort of happens gradually, and sometimes you may go back and make changes to a part of the code simply because you feel there's a better way of doing things, or it will help some other aspect of the code. And then maybe a couple of days later, you realize that, no, maybe the first approach was correct. And so you have to revert everything back. And systems like JIT and Subversion, or in general, revision control systems, help in that you can quickly revert back to a previous version without your having to explicitly remember all the changes you have made. So maybe now people can quickly we can quickly contribute by specifying which editors we're familiar with or which of these tools we're familiar with. Victor reports that he continues to have problems, but is it okay now that you don't have the video coming from my side? So there's nobody sending video right now. Is it okay, or are there still problems? I think also you can probably also improve your bandwidth by minimizing the Zoom client and opening the presentation. And so you just follow us, but you'll have to manually paste your own presentation. So the smaller you make your Zoom client, the less bandwidth it consumes. It's sort of an automatic way for managing bandwidth with Zoom. Okay, so is anyone going to mention an editor, or maybe type the name of an editor they are familiar with? Or let me ask, how many of us have done some programming? Okay, so somebody mentions Notepad. Notepad is a well-known editor on the Windows platform. Okay. So we have Hannah too, who's probably done some things with NetBeans. Okay. Have you used NetBeans only for Java or for some other programming language? And then there's Atom. Okay. Sublime. Okay, that's good. These are various IDE related. Eclipse. Okay, that's good. So I guess people are quite familiar with programming. Okay, so thank you for this contributions. Okay, what about languages? Was it for programming in Java, for programming in C, C++, or some other language? Okay, so we have C, C++, and Java from Efyong. Hannah too says Java, C, and Python. Okay, so Hannah too, you were probably referring to Dev C++, is that right? Or NetBeans? So were you using NetBeans so you use Dev C++ for also programming in Python. Okay. I'm not very familiar with all these tools. I guess So forgive me if I make some glaring, obvious mistakes. Yeah. Okay, there's also something called code blocks IDE, if I may contribute, code blocks IDE. Okay, we'll move on to the next slide. Thank you for your contributions here. Okay, so this is a slide about data types, and the focus is on integers. So I don't know if you've probably realized, but there are various kinds of integers, right? So there's the character, okay, there's the short integer, the integer, the long, okay, and basically, these are the various data types one will have come across. Okay, so Efyong has suggested PyDroid for programming Python on the I believe that's on the Android platform. Okay, thank you very much for that. Okay, so what are your views about these data types? Which is easier for a computer? Which sort of is fastest to work with? 8 bits or 32 bits or 64 bits? Any take by anyone? What are your views or your thoughts about the use of bits? Okay, so interestingly enough, Emmanuel says 64 bits is going to be fastest than working with data that is 64 bits is going to be fastest. Does everyone agree with that? Hannah too says 8 bits. Okay, and Efyong says the one that is related to the data being used, the one related to the data that is being processed or being worked on. Okay, I will probably go with Hannah too right now. Okay. So because Efyong is suggesting, the smaller the bit or the smaller the size of the byte, the less memory it requires. So if we look at 64-bit systems, okay, 64 bits is exactly 8 times 8 bits, yeah? So what this means is that in one data transfer operation, the computer can transfer 8 characters or 8 numbers if we're looking at 8 bits. So if we're assuming that we're only working with 8-bit numbers, so a 64-bit bus is able to transfer 8 numbers at the same time as opposed to transferring a single 64-bit number. So in general, the smaller the size of the data, the faster it is to process. So working with 8-bit data is seen as the fastest possible solution. And in fact, I think one of the notable techniques for speeding up machine learning and related applications that's sort of emerging in the last few, probably in the last couple of years has been trying to sort of make sure the model only processes 8-bit data. Okay, and that way it works very fast as opposed to processing 64-bit data. Okay, what if, so the truth is many applications we are going to come across have to work with fractions. So not just whole numbers that can be represented by integers. So for fractions, we have two ways of representing them in computing. So there's always the standard floating point numbers, as well as the there's the single floating point numbers or single precision floating point numbers, and the double precision floating point numbers. And then there are now some systems that support the so-called long double precision numbers. So you get 80 bits of precision. So even much more, I mean, you get an 80-bit structure for storing the number. So it's even much more interesting. So what is important to understand is that as the size of the number of bits grow, the more memory that is used up and the more time we spend processing. Interestingly enough, computers do not store floating point numbers the way we think about them. They have to store them as a mathematical operation. So if you see on the right-hand side of the screen, I have given several mathematical representations, okay, that are the standard ways of working with, or are the standard ways that computers internally store floating point numbers. So each time the computer has to store a floating point number or even read a floating point number, it has to perform these equations. So it does some computation to even arrive at the number that is going to be presented as the floating point number. And so that tends to consume time. And the bigger the floating point number, the more time is going to spend trying to, in these basic operations of putting it in memory, reading it in memory. And another interesting aspect of floating point numbers, especially when writing code, is that you are encouraged to avoid the equality test. Because there's always a loss of bits when working with precision, we understand that floating point numbers may not be exactly the same, especially if you arrive there from two different approaches. To illustrate that, I don't think I have that slide here. Okay, well, probably I think as part of the homework, we might have an exercise that helps us illustrate this. But the key idea is that there's a difference between carrying out the operation 3 divided by 10, okay, and adding that up 3 times, and doing 0.3 times 3. So the way we did the calculation always affects a number when we are going to work with floating point numbers. And so it's a good programming practice not to use the equality test, especially when you are working with floating point numbers. Okay, so I think I will share the link to the recordings of the class afterwards. So you can always go through, especially for those parts where you have missed my discussions or missed what I'm saying. And then if you have questions that, especially for those sections which you are missing right now, you can always send them to me by email. Okay, this is for Emmanuel. Did you get that?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Yeah, okay, sorry, so I'm guessing many of us are also familiar with operators. So operators, things like your division, your multiplication, your parenthesis, addition, subtraction. You also have relational operators, which help you to test relationship between entities. And then there are the logical operators, as well as the binary operators. Okay. And then some people who have done some more advanced programming may have met the hybrid operators, which are the plus equal to, the multiplication equal to, and the things like division equal to. Okay, so I have a question. Have you ever thought about it that some operators could be faster than other operators? If so, which ones? What do you think? Are there any contributions or comments from the class on this? Are some operators faster than other operators? Yes or no? Okay, somebody raise their hand. Okay, Margaret.
I think the some are faster, like the plus operator. I think the way computer does times or minus is still going back to plus. Times can be plus, 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 plus. So, and plus is still, and minus is another way of plus. So, plus is faster.
Okay. Okay. That's quite good. Is there any other or any contrary opinion or ideas? I think everyone agrees that the addition is the fastest operation for a computer. Interestingly enough, I think I also agree with what she mentioned, which is the fact that even when you ask the computer to carry out a multiplication, it typically just does an addition. So a multiplication is always a sequence of additions. Okay. And similarly, things like division and stuff like that come out to be that way. What about subtraction? What do you have to say about subtraction?
I think plus is still faster than subtraction because computer still does a way of, I think it's a complementary plus or so to get a minus.
Yes, so you are right. So if it's going to do subtraction, it's going to calculate the two's complement and then add that, okay, to get the subtracted number. Okay, so I guess you all are very, very brilliant students. Okay, and you're quite familiar, or you have some familiarity with programming and the some of the intricacies of programming. So so let's just also look at another aspects of developing programs. So we tend to classify various instructions or various statements as they can be classified as executable, non-executable, control, input-output. They could be built-in functions, they could be functions, subroutines, or even logical operations. So just as a further test, I'm going to ask you to probably one by one, so just raise up your hand and then I'll call on you and you probably tell me for each of these items we have on the screen here, So for the statement X is equal to 42, what do you think it is? X is equal to 42. Okay, so we have Margaret and Hannah too. Let's go with Hannah too.
Executable.
Okay, it's you say it's an executable statement. Yeah. I mean, feel free if I didn't specify something that is supposed to be on this list that is not there, feel free to mention it. You don't have to go with my restricted list. So are you going with executable? Okay, so you can also look at X is equal to 42 as an assignment statement. Okay, I'm sure you must have come across that term, assignment. So we're assigning 42 to the value of X, to the variable called X. So Margaret, can you take the next one, break?
So I'm not sure of break.
Okay. Any other person, Emmanuel, you want to make an attempt at break?
Yeah, break falls into the category of control statement because it tells the program to break some codes so as to jump to another set of codes. So it's among the control statements.
Okay, that's quite right. So break is for control of program execution. Margaret, do you want to try with if?
Maybe logical. Because it's like considering maybe if this, then this. Maybe it's going with logical.
Okay. Does everyone agree with that? Okay.
It also falls into the category of functions, sir.
Okay. If is a very, very interesting beast in that it's conditional. Yeah. So it allows you to evaluate certain conditions. So it could also, in a sense, influence control, act as a control. Yeah. Okay, so F open. F open.
So I think it's a built-in function.
Okay. You are right. It's probably built into many languages, but is there something much more specific than built in for F?
It's used to open like a URL or a file in your computer.
Yes, but
open, if you want, as if you're coding and you want to be able to access a file, open a URL or a file.
For what purpose?
For input output.
Good. For input. So typically F open allows us to open something, either a URL or a local file.
Exactly.
For input. Yeah. So it's falls solidly in input-output type of statement. What about printf?
It's an output.
Okay, okay. There are some people that haven't said anything in a while. So Ibrahim hasn't said anything in a while. I believe Mary hasn't said anything in a while. So Ibrahim, what do you think about SQRT?
I just spoke F open.
Oh, was that... was that Mary? Okay. Okay, so Ibrahim, what do you think of SQRT? Is Ibrahim with us? Okay, probably we'll assume he's not here. Okay, so I guess SQRT, anybody wants to contribute?
It's a function.
Okay, yeah. Victor?
Okay, so it's actually a function, and it's also executable because it executes the input to it.
Okay.
Mainly an a built-in function to process.
Okay. Okay. So, will it surprise you if I tell you that SQRT is not a built-in function? Yeah. It's typically an add-on, even to the standard maths library. I think it's not part of the standard maths library. But it's a function. It's a heavy function, as in it's computationally intensive. Okay, so x is less than 5. X is less than 5.
Yes, I think it's logical.
Okay, so it's just testing two objects against themselves. And then the next line, which is the char asterisk mem copy CPY. In C lingo, we'll say this is character pointer to mem CPY. Any ideas?
I think it's executable a statement which copy the memory with the data type character.
I would have said non-executable, or I have it down at squarely non-executable, because it simply defines the type of an object.
Okay.
Its only role is just to tell the compiler that we are expecting a character pointer or a pointer to an array of characters. Yeah?
Okay. Okay, sir.
So typically, you either use this at the beginning when you are defining your variables. Okay.
Okay,
so they don't really assign anything. They don't even initialize your variable, but they just tell the compiler that that's the type of the of your variable. Does anyone disagree? Okay. So I guess the remaining two are quite easy.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
it is about, I was thinking maybe it was a function, because in some languages they use it to like copy characters. So I didn't think of it as logical.
Okay, so if I said MCPY braces, that's a function, yeah? But when okay. I put car pointer MCPY or MemCPY, okay, it's the standard C syntax for telling the compiler we're predefining. Probably this MCPY exists in another library, maybe in the system library, but I want to be able to use it in my program or as part of my code. Okay, in order to do this, I have to specify a line like this that tells the compiler that this object is really, the output from this object is going to be a character pointer. So if I'm going to receive output from this function, it must be into an object that accepts pointers to characters. Okay. Anyhow, we'll probably do some practicals with all of this. Maybe we might do some C programming a bit later. Okay, maybe next week. Okay, thank you all for the contributions. Okay, and they are all quite useful. So, interestingly enough, for many programming languages, there tend to be two types of operators, especially for input and output. There's a separate function for input and a separate function for output. And then certain times you have to make a distinction between the kind of data you want to input or the kind of data you want to output. You might want to just read in text files or read in binary files, or you want to sort of read things sequentially or read things randomly. Okay, so sequentially means you have to start from the beginning and then go one by one up until. So if you have a data file that is a collection of records, maybe it has 500 records and I want to access record number 250. If I'm opening the file sequentially, it means I always have to start from record number one and then read up until 250 before I can get my data. And random access, on the other hand, says, okay, I simply jump, open the file, and I can jump immediately to record number 250. So this tends to imply that random access is going to be faster than sequential access, especially when reading the records that are with the higher number records. So if I need to read record 400, I'll expect random access to provide me the data almost immediately, while sequential will have a delay as it has to read other records. Outputs as well, you can create files when they don't exist. You can overwrite files, or you can also append to files. There are a list of functions here. So there's fopen, which we saw earlier, printf, scanf, fgetc, fclose, fputc, and ongetc. So one question is, what's the impact of scanf versus fgetc? So fgetc tends to read only one character at a time, whereas scanf will read a whole record at a time. So in this sense, scanf is always faster than fgetc. Fgetc will always return one character, whereas scanf will read the entire record. So even if it has 20 characters, it reads all of it in one go. It returns all of it in one go, whereas fgetc will require 20 calls to fgetc to get that whole record. The same applies to printf and fputc. So fputc will output one character and printf can output a whole record at once. Okay. So we've had a very interesting time with software. And I guess one exercise will have been, can we identify some techniques, I mean, based on what we have just looked at now, for improving the performance of a computer application or a software?
We can improve by using the programming language which require the use of some functionalities and the other input input text which does not require the use of huge memory to compile or to execute those programs. For instance, if we, as we have seen the effects of printf and these fputc, we can avoid use these kind of statements which lower the performance by using a lot of memory in executing different kinds of programs.
Okay, so I think if I summarize correctly, your contribution is that we should minimize the use of heavy functions, right? Or minimize in general the use of input-output functions.
Yes, sir.
Is it the first one or the second one, A or B?
Minimize the use of heavy functions in writing programs.
Okay. So minimize the, so let me go there. Sorry, was that Emmanuel?
Yes, sir. It's Emmanuel.
Okay. Minimize the use of heavy functions. Okay. Okay, any other contributions?
Hello, sir. I think, hello?
Yes, we're listening.
Okay, sir, it's Brian, sorry. We can actually make efficient use of data objects.
Okay, data types. You mean?
Yes, exactly. Like the integers, the floating points, and all of that appropriately. So.
Okay, so your contribution is try to use integer or 8-bit data types.
Yes, sir. Appropriately.
Appropriate. And this is from Ibrahim. Yeah. Okay, so any other person? Okay, somebody's suggesting garbage collection. Would you like to explain? Hannah too. Okay. So will the question be to avoid garbage collection or to aggressively perform garbage collection? I don't know if she can hear me.
I think.
Okay.
I think maybe she meant aggressively collecting garbage, so as to minimize the usage of memory. That is my own view.
Okay. But then if you aggressively collect garbage, shouldn't that slow down your application? You use less memory, but you spend more time looking for garbage than executing the program. I mean, it's a... Anyway, we'll leave it there. I mean... I'll put a question mark.
Prof.
Maybe she can explain to Ross. Yes.
The use of logical
Okay, am I the only one who lost audio from
operators as controlling like a break now in terms of like quick execution code? Hello?
Yes. I think we didn't get the middle part. Okay.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, this is Blessing F. Young, right?
Efficient use of
Okay, is this fine? Use control statements efficiently. Hello? Okay, please feel free to also just type something in the chat, okay? That's F. Young. If my sort of summary is wrong for what you intended, then just type it in the chat, as we seem to be having some difficulty with audio. Yes?
I think the use of an active antivirus to, in case there's a virus in your system that can slow down the performance. With an antivirus, the software tool that can help to avoid that.
Okay. Yes, I'll take that here. Use of antivirus to boost system performance. And this was Margaret. And then we had use of system optimization software, and this was Hawa. Okay. So we have Mary saying increasing and upgrading of RAM. Is this really software, Mary? This doesn't really look like a software technique. It means I have to open the computer.
I think it's kind of hardware, but of improving the performance.
Yeah, it's hardware to improve performance. Increasing. And upgrading RAM. Yeah, I think it's clearly hardware, so we won't put it on the software list. We were supposed to fill something for hardware. Okay. So we also have Ibrahim saying having a large memory space to accommodate programs. Victor suggests frequent defragmentation. Yeah. Mary also suggests this cleanup and defragmentation. Use of quick error detection, detecting IDEs on your codes. Okay, reducing number of startup programs. Okay, these are quite interesting. I guess maybe my question was wrong because I was looking more at the context of we are trying to write some software application. We're trying to develop some software application. And how can we make this software application faster? So I guess we're also okay with 6 suggestions, which is minimizing the use of heavy functions, trying to make sure we're only using 8-bit data types. Hannah too is suggesting garbage collection. I think she made some additional comments in the chat for those variables that are not in use but occupying memory. So selective garbage collection. Okay, then use control statements efficiently. Okay. Hawa suggests using system optimization software. So in principle, that could be applied by simply adding an additional flag, an optimization flag to your compiler. It will try to try and optimize the program. And then Margaret suggests the use of antivirus to boost system performance. There are other suggestions like reducing number of startup programs from Mary, who's not on the list. Number of start. Okay, programs, Mary. Okay, so thank you. I think we can actually close the list here. Okay. And then at this point, we are going to move on to trying to start talking about HPC. So we've basically looked at an introduction very briefly, the architecture of the microprocessor. And we've seen how various parts of the microprocessor can be bottlenecks. I think in probably subsequent slides or even other lessons, we'll discuss a bit more about some of these bottlenecks that exist at the microprocessor level. And then we looked at software. We've also looked at how you can code different kinds of statements and things like that, which are heavy functions, which are built-in functions. I was expecting somebody to suggest maybe trying to perform computations using only additions as opposed to multiplications. That might be an interesting idea to try out, or to avoid using the heavier functions like square roots. If possible, we can identify alternative algorithms for implementing square roots as opposed to depending on the machine to perform square roots. Why will we do this? Because we know that the computer is faster at doing additions than divisions or multiplications. So if we can figure out a way to use additions to compute square roots, then we're in business. Ibrahim suggests using 8-bit data types, which is very, very useful, because the smaller our data types, the less memory we'll use, and the faster our computer can transfer this data around from memory to processor and vice versa. Hanatu suggests garbage collection, or trying to eliminate memory of variables that are not in use. F. Young suggests paying attention to the flow of the application so that you can minimize the use of control statements and jumps, or use them efficiently. So Hawa speaks about optimizing your code using some software for optimization. And this in principle could be your compiler, as you mean you are compiling code. Margaret suggests antivirus, and then Mary reducing the number of startup applications. Nobody suggested avoiding using interpreters. We should always aim to either compile, develop our code in a language that can be compiled, or in a language that is as close as possible to assembly language. So using Python is quick for prototyping, but for performance during production, it's better to use a C version or a compiled version of the application. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. Yes,
okay.
Sir. Yes, sir.
Okay, so now we move on to looking at high-performance computing.
Please, I have a question.
Okay, go for it.
So among this list, can we include use of, like, avoiding use of go-to statements, or is it also part of the control?
Avoiding use of
go-to statements.
Yes, go-to, I think it's control.
Okay, so
okay. So yeah, we can avoid use of go-to statements if we can. Yes. Okay. So it's part of the list. We'll probably be able to associate it with item number 4. Okay. So high performance computing. Some colleagues have also called it high productivity computing. Okay, so one, I think probably the most general way of seeing high-performance computing. So each time I say HPC, I tend to mean high-performance computing. So in general, HPC is really about exploiting and aggregating the gains we can obtain from optimizing hardware configurations and software tuning or changes for producing faster results, okay? So very generally, HPC is mainly concerned with optimally improving the use of computing resources, either the hardware or the software, okay? Being able to use them more efficiently because we understand them better. Okay, so this course is really about HPC as a computer-based tool or vehicle for scientific research, okay, that is suited for obtaining faster results and addressing increasingly bigger problem domains. So the interesting thing is that in computer science, we tend to see HPC in two different directions. I'm going to briefly mention the second direction before the end of the day. But things like cloud computing and virtualization are considered HPC in computer science. But we're not going to focus on that aspect under this course. Under this course, we are looking more at improving the speed and performance of scientific software for research purposes. So the reason why virtualization and cloud computing is seen as high performance computing is because they try to make better use of your processing power. So by virtualizing, it means I can run two applications on the same processor simply by context switching or some other means. Okay, but our focus is not virtualization, but our focus is more on scientific applications and how we can obtain the best, the optimal performance from software code, which we have written or which we are involved in developing. So we'll identify strategies for improving the code we write or even improving code written by other people to make them run faster or even to make them produce better results or produce larger results even with the limited amount of resources that are available. Okay, is that clear? So we're not going to cover a lot of cloud computing or cloud computing related aspects of HPC here, but we're only focusing on this aspect. Okay, so we'll do more of programming. Okay, so our focus is on science. Why science? Why the focus on science? I'm sure even we may have realized that even people who are not computer scientists or who are not doing computer science now use computers in their various disciplines. Even social scientists are now talking about HPC. They now want to have HPC. They now want to be able to do high performance computing. Why? Because they want their results faster. Because some of the problems they are looking at are growing in complexity or scale. And solutions require everyone to put their heads together from multiple disciplines. For example, some of the experiments that are going on in physics are expected to make contributions in the health sector. Are expected to make contributions that could be useful for addressing things like cancer or some other unknown diseases or even things that are happening in biology. Okay. And it is clear that for many of these disciplines where they have limitations in knowledge and training, the kind of software they will develop will probably perform poorly and always waste resources. Okay, is that clear? Are there any questions or examples about this?
Yes, it's clear.
Okay, so essentially what I'm trying to point out is the fact that even a social scientist, somebody who you feel is going to spend their time administering questionnaires about maybe who are the members of a household, population, okay, and things like that. Now want to use computers for addressing some of the challenges. So let me give you a typical example. Assuming during the population, during a census, a population census, they are also collecting data about the weight of each individual, okay? And then at the end of the day, we're looking at Nigeria, of course. At the end of the day, they would like to be able to calculate the average weight of the citizens or inhabitants nationally. They also want to be able to calculate this on the geopolitical zones, or even at the state level, or even at the local government level, or even at the, let's say, the sub-city or the fractions of the city level, or at the city level, right? Will that be interesting? I think they will find it interesting. It's going to be data that will also be useful for medical purposes, because they can correlate it with what they are seeing at the various health centers and clinics. So the point is, in Nigeria, I think you have about roughly 200 million people, right? Or there are 200 million inhabitants in Nigeria. And so calculating the average means that you have to sort of add the number 200 million times, or add certain numbers together and then divide by 200 million. And that's going to give you your average. Now, if your scientist had to do this using a calculator, it's going to be a large piece of work. And then maybe it turns out that his laptop is not able to hold the data for 200 million people. So he has a challenge there in being able to keep all this data in memory and then process them at the same time, right? And then he now says, okay, maybe instead of all of Nigeria, let's also do Lagos State, you know, and maybe by the time he finishes processing to get down to a city level, he will probably have some white hair, and he may have spent a couple of years just trying to sort of walk through all this data. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so
yes, sir.
It does suggest that even people who are doing social science need HPC. Okay, so HPC is really seen as something that can be an interdisciplinary vehicle as well. So you have computer scientists working alongside people from social science to address issues related to complexity, scale, and then providing solutions to scientific problems. Somebody wanted to say something. Was that Emmanuel?
Yes, sir. The way I see this HPC is more of like dealing with the large amount of data in performing some mathematical expressions, which will give out the output in a very low or a very limited time. So is this all about HPC? Like we have, for instance, we are collecting data and we have to do some mathematical computation on those data so as to get an output within a short period of time so as to allow us to make decision. So is that HPC is all about, or is more than that?
HPC is actually more than that. So it's not just about processing data, but it's also about performing efficient computations. Okay, so I believe part of what we're going to be looking at maybe next week might be very interesting. Okay, especially when you look at the fact that you can. I guess if you are used to programming, you are probably used to writing loops. So either you have a for statement or a while statement or a do statement. Okay, but they basically loop until certain conditions are met. Okay. We are going to look at ways at which you can improve this. So it's not only about the data, but also about being efficient in computation. Okay.
Okay, sir.
Sometimes it also might involve choosing the right algorithm, okay, for your computations. Okay. Okay, we'll see, we'll talk a bit more about this as the days go on. So maybe at the end of the class or at the end of the course, you might be able to appreciate if it's only just about data or if it's more than that. Okay, so somebody asked a question, Hannah too. And the question is hyper-threading an aspect of HPC? Hyper-threading. Let me see. Will we meet hyper-threading? I think I have a slide about hyper-threading later on. It's a bit of so I won't say it's part of a solution. It could also be a problem for HPC. So in, let's say, before 5 years ago, the consistent view was that hyper-threading was a problem for HPC. But today, thanks to developments in hyper-threading and probably CPU design, I think Intel has redesigned hyper-threading several times. Otherwise, we always had this advice that if you are going to deploy HPC, switch off hyper-threading. It was more of a slowing down of the system than not. But nowadays, I think we can survive with it. Your compilers are better, and there are software tools that already can help you to optimally use or even avoid the gotchas that early hyper-threading implementations provided. But we'll discuss this in details as we go on. Okay, so focusing on science as well, I also want to talk about the paradigm of science. We are computer scientists, or we are going to be computer scientists. As soon as you finish your BSc, you're already a computer scientist. The basic idea behind science is the fact that you can observe, you can relate things to theory, and you can also build experiments to either support the theory behind what you've observed or disprove the things that you've observed. Okay, so the key paradigm in science has always been, or the key pillars of science, any scientific discipline, as whether you are talking about the natural sciences, the health sciences, social sciences, has always been these three items: observations, theories, and experimentation. Okay. Interestingly enough, this paradigm has been here for, I will say, the last 200 years or more. But nowadays, we are seeing a shift towards the use of computing resources or the use of computers for science as well. So you can see, even if you observe, you develop theories, many times you don't have to perform physical experiments anymore. You can use simulations. You can develop computer models. Okay, and this can help you better understand things in various disciplines. For example, a lot of the study about the early universe, okay, things that happened at the creation, okay, or just immediately after the creation, is only possible through simulations. So the scientific disciplines that deal with that have to use a lot of computer simulations to figure out what's going to happen there. Just a minute. I seem to have a call from my boss. Hello, can you hear me now?
Yes, bro.
Yes, bro, we can hear you.
Sorry about that. My boss called me about a problem. So I thought maybe they had an emergency. So I was trying to respond to that. Okay, so... Okay, so yes, studies about the things that happen in the early universe can only be achieved through things like simulation. I think that's where we left off, right?
Okay. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So the interesting thing is that you can also use computing or computers in the stage of observation. So for example, under the first item here, observe, it's possible to apply computers because there are some problems that are very hard. So for example, we want to study the effects of wind on a very large plane. I think you must have heard of the ABOS, is it 328, which is supposed to be the largest aircraft in the world. Okay, so usually when you are designing an aircraft or even a car, there's always the idea that you can subject it to wind at various speed, in order to understand how the structure is going to behave and how the structure reacts with high-speed wind. And the traditional approach is to build something called a wind tunnel, okay? And then put the object inside the car or the airplane and then drive the air over it. And then you measure the flow of air and things like that using sensors. Unfortunately, for some of these large aircrafts, especially the A328, it was not possible because building such a wind tunnel would have been a massive undertaking. So they had to study and even get data simply using simulations alone. And of course, you'll also understand that it was too expensive to even build a prototype. So if we're going to build a wind tunnel to study a plane, we would have built a prototype and then now try to put it inside a wind tunnel. But that could be a very expensive gesture. And then things like working with lasers. It's also quite expensive to prototype lasers. If you look at the people that study weather and climate events, or even the geologists, they tend to want to look at, or they want to say, okay, 40 million years ago, the weather was like this. There was a lot of ice around. I mean, you may have heard geologists talk about that. But the point is, it's not possible for them to repeat that experiment because it happened 40 million years ago. And you may have to wait 40 million years to understand how things have evolved. So instead, they depend on simulations to try and figure this out or to try and better understand how that is happening. And then for weather and climate, they tend to also consume a lot of data. So if you... I don't know if it will surprise you to understand that telling you the weather over Abuja today may have involved using data from as far back as 150 years ago. Okay, just to try and tell you what the weather in Abuja is going to be like in the next 3 days. So the forecast that goes on TV, on radio about weather, or that you will get on your cell phone from those apps, tend to depend on research work that involves a lot of data. And it's not like they have somebody who's very smart at predicting weather. is just data and some mathematical equations. I think the Runge-Kutta equations that are used mainly for climate research. In some other areas, it's quite dangerous and controversial. So trying to work on nuclear or radioactive material is quite dangerous for health. Or nowadays, trying to work on stem cells, okay, is also quite difficult for research. So since it's not approved by most governments. So the bottom line is that computers can help a lot in even gathering data or making observations about what's happening in various disciplines of science. For one reason or the other. Okay, so we are now going to sort of move away from science. The science aspect was just to sort of show us the necessity, and then we'll talk about the interesting. I mean, we'll move now to the HPC. So like we said at the beginning of this section on HPC, you can consider it to be high productivity computing or high performance computing. So in general, we'll say that you can obtain an improvement in performance or productivity using one of three different approaches. You can work faster, you can work harder. Okay, that's faster or harder is actually on the same point here. You can also work smarter and you can work in parallel. So working harder and faster, for example, if my laptop is slow, okay, maybe I bought the laptop in 2011 and it's time to get an upgrade. So if I simply upgrade to a new laptop, it has a faster processor, right? And maybe even has more RAM. Okay, and instead of having a hard disk, it may have an SSD. So these are ways of making my laptop work faster. And working smarter is more on the software side of things. Maybe I need to change the algorithm I'm using. Maybe I wrote my application to only use floating point numbers because I wanted to have a good amount of precision. But maybe my application didn't really need floating point numbers. It's working mainly with integers. Then if I simply redefine my variables as integers instead of floating point or single precision numbers or double precision numbers, I'll get a boost in performance. Or another option is I have an application that needs floating point numbers, but maybe I don't really need so much precision. So instead of using double precision numbers, I simply switch to single precision. I'll also get a boost in performance. That's working smarter. And you can also change the techniques. So maybe instead of calling square root, I can simply use divisions, okay, to arrive at the same answer for square root. And you'll see that it comes out faster. And the third option is working in parallel, trying to do things in parallel at the same time, concurrently. And this is where we are going to be moving on to some of the concepts we may have encountered during our undergraduate days in computing. We'll probably mention a bit of concurrency, hyper-threading, and eventually parallel. They are sort of like different approaches, and they have different implications for performance. We'll probably come to that. But let's start with trying to look at them working faster or harder. Okay, so basically we're approaching the end of our 3-hour mark. Am I right? Yeah. So maybe we will not finish all the slides I had earmarked today, but we'll simply go along with the pace of Is everybody comfortable with the pace? Is it too slow? Feel free to type in the chat if you feel our pace has been too slow or too fast. If I've been going too fast as well, also just let me know. Yeah. I hope Victor is back. Yeah, it looks like he's back. Yes. Okay. Okay. Okay.
Okay. Yes, I'm back. Thank you.
The concession appears to be that the pace is okay. We're not going too fast or too slow. So we will probably break soon. Okay, we might not finish everything, but we still had a couple of topics to go. I think, yeah, maybe we'll spend 5 minutes at the end discussing homework one, and then we'll move on. Okay, so hardware-wise, will it surprise you if I tell you that you can actually do HPC on your mobile device, on your cell phones? Is that interesting, or is that, I guess many of you might be asking how, why, or what's the key idea there? And then you can also do HPC on computers. And you can do HPC on something called clusters. We're going to also look at, we're going to spend most of our time on clusters. But the idea is the concept, the HPC concept, can be applied on various platforms. From mobile devices, anything that has a modern processor can in principle be used for HPC. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we have grid computing, cloud computing, and supercomputers. Nowadays, not just supercomputers, but also even cybersecurity infrastructures. Okay. But we will focus mostly on clusters, and then I can probably explain a bit about how you can do HPC on mobile devices on your cell phone. Okay. So we have an exercise. Can we identify a few differences between single processor and multiprocessor computer architecture? Is everybody familiar with the terms single processor and multiprocessor? If anybody hasn't met any of these terms before or would like me to explain them, please indicate or send a chat or raise your hand. Okay. Okay, so it seems to be that everyone has met a single processor and multiprocessor computer architecture. Although Ibrahim is suggesting, I still provide an explanation. Maybe the best way of thinking about it might be to refer you back to this diagram. So this diagram, the square, the quadrant we have here, represents a single processor. Okay. So in a single processor computer, it has only one CPU. And of course, it means we have just one bus bringing data to the CPU and taking data away from the CPU. So that's the CPU that is responsible for your RAM, working with your drives, controlling your mouse, and things like that. In a multiprocessor computer, instead of one CPU, we'll have several of these. We'll have two or more of these quadrants inside the computer, and they coordinate among themselves to take care of everything about the computer. So they'll coordinate the use of the bus if necessary. They'll coordinate the use of who drives the mouse. They'll coordinate who's running the application, the Zoom application you are running right now. They'll coordinate IO, so who's going to talk to the hard disk or talk to the drives and things like that. Okay, so basically that's the difference between the single processor and the multiprocessor machines. We are going to also eventually go a bit more in detail about that later on, but I don't think we'll do that just right away. Okay, so hopefully better explanations will come up about that. So the key thing to understand is that computers can be single processor or multi-processors. So they can have one CPU or more than one CPU. I hope we understand when I say CPU, I'm not talking of the box that sits on your table if it's a desktop, but I'm looking at the internal microprocessor of the computer. So essentially what I'm saying is that a multiprocessor is having more than one microprocessor, and a single processor is having just one microprocessor in the computer, okay? Clusters, on the other hand, tend to be connections of computers. So several computers working together to provide us with working in a coordinated manner as a single computer. So the question will be, how do mobile devices do HPC? Or why do I say mobile devices can do HPC? Yeah, anybody who has an idea? I'm saying mobile devices can do HPC. Excuse me, I'm going to take a drink.
I think like the RAM size, if you're using one with a better RAM size, the performance of your mobile computer will be better.
Okay, so a phone with more RAM can perform better than a phone with less RAM. Yeah, that's quite true. But I think there's a more important difference. Have you noticed that most of the phones you can buy now are quad core or octal core? Yeah? You don't see any phone anymore that they tell you is just single core. So what does this mean? Essentially, it means that inside that phone, you have four processors, if it's a quad core. If it's an octal core, then it has eight processors. It may have one physical microprocessor, but internally, there are four or eight distinct microprocessors inside. And if I can coordinate the working together of these eight processors, it means I can use them to do some interesting calculations very fast. And our main goal, or I think one of the main outputs we hope to get from this series of classes or this course, is going to be the fact that at the end of the course, you will understand how to achieve this. So if I bring you a cell phone and I say this is a quad core cell phone, and I say this is an application that has been developed, can you tell me strategies of how to improve the performance of this application on the mobile phone? You'll be able to do it in the same way as you might be able to get it to, carry out the same exercise on a laptop device, or even a HPC cluster, okay? So the speaker was suggesting, it's also a question of RAM. Okay, so maybe if I'm using a single processor in my cell phone, I can only process data from one street. But if I harness the quad core they have inside the cell phone, I will be able to process data from maybe 4 streets at the same time. So this should automatically mean that if I'm trying to process data for a whole city, I'm doing it one street at a time will take me, let's say, maybe several days. I'm doing it with 4 streets at a time, I'll cut down on the number of, I'll cut down the amount of time I spend processing this data. And this is achievable on a cell phone, on a desktop computer, on a laptop computer, or on bigger platforms. And whereas clusters might give us the results in minutes, cell phones might give us in days, and computers, we might be able to do it in hours. Okay. Okay, so just to help us understand a bit better, let's discuss one of the early taxonomy for classifying microprocessors or computers. Yeah? So I think there was a gentleman called Flynn in 1966 that came up with this system. I'm sure you may have met this method of classifications or Flynn's taxonomy from your early undergraduate days. Anyhow, it's basically trying to classify computers and microprocessors into 4 distinct categories. The first kind are single instruction, single data, which means that your microprocessor works by reading a single machine code instruction, and it expects that instruction to be followed by a single instance of data. So if we are focusing on 8-bit systems, an SISD microprocessor will simply read the first byte as the machine code instruction, then the next byte is going to be data. So it keeps alternating between single instruction, single data. Much more, I think there are very few processors. There were only the early processors belong to this category. And much more common nowadays are the SIMD. Okay. Which tend to say, okay, I can have a single instruction, but it will process multiple data. So for example, I have an instruction to multiply. And then the next data I'm supplying is going to be the two data that I want to multiply between themselves. So that's a single instruction, but it's acting on multiple data. I hope we get it. We are going to see that GPUs take this to another level compared to CPUs. So most of the processors in your laptop, in your desktop computers, in your cell phones, belong in this category of SIMD, okay, as well as GPUs that we are going to be looking at later on. And then another instance is multiple instructions, multiple data. So they can accept a sequence of instructions, and then and those instructions are then repeatedly performed on one instance of data. Okay. There are probably just a few experimental examples of this kind of computers worldwide. And then the fourth category are the multiple instructions, multiple data. So they are capable of at the same time reading multiple instructions and working on multiple and different data together. And this is where we tend to have the clusters and the supercomputers. Okay, I think we'll probably give some more explanation later on about how to achieve this. But for now, just say we are most of our computers, a single desktop or laptop computer should be considered as an SIMD approach to computing. Okay. So in order to answer the questions about hyperthreading and concurrency, excuse me. We should consider this diagram, which sort of looks at, gives us a brief, a very quick overview of the evolution of the microprocessor. We're not considering processors before Pentium, but we're only looking at the Pentium family all the way to Westmere, which is now an older processor. It's no longer a very recent processor. It's probably almost 8 or 9 years old now. So the Pentiums were notable because they were the first CPUs to introduce the idea that for performance sake, I can have my processor and memory on the same integrated circuit, on the same silicon chip. So that's why you can see here that in Pentium 1, we have cache and then core. So the core represents what we saw before, your arithmetic logic units, your registers, your control units, your program counters, your stack pointer. And then the cache serves as a very fast buffer to your RAM or to your disk or something like that. So the processor, the core, can bring in data from your RAM or from your disk and immediately put them in cache to act on them. Okay. Around the time of the Pentiums, we also started hearing some buzzwords, things like pipelining, context switching, and stuff like that, that we might talk about later on. But if you compare a Pentium 1 to a Pentium 2, what's the difference between these two? Graphically, you can see here that the cache has grown compared to the Pentium 1. So in the Pentium 1, the percentage of the chip, of the die, of the silicon chip that was memory was smaller compared to Pentium 2. So it's bigger in Pentium 2. So in Pentium 3, you can see that it's also grown in size. So just to give us a rough idea of this situation. So let's say a Pentium 1 processor had a 4K cache. That's 4 kilobytes of cache. A Pentium 2 may have increased this to something like 64K. Okay. And then Pentium 3 may have taken this to 1 megabyte of cache. So you can see that there's an order of magnitude of difference in the size of the cache, but it made a very big difference in the performance of the processor. So even for the same clock speeds, the Pentium 3 was capable of processing data much faster than a Pentium 1, simply because it has a bigger cache, okay? Or has a bigger memory closer to the processor. When we got to the Pentium 4, Intel introduced something called hyper-threading. Hyper-threading, probably I don't have the slides in this presentation. Maybe there's a different presentation where I have a slide that tries to explain that. But essentially, what did Intel do with hyper-threading? So they have more or less the same cache, but they also have the same green part for control. In order to understand hyper-threading, we need to go back to this diagram. So what does hyper-threading do? Hyper-threading simply says, I have duplicates for these registers. I have duplicates for the program counter, and I have duplicates for the stack pointer, but I don't duplicate the arithmetic logic unit, nor the decoder. So what does this mean? Only portions of your microprocessor were duplicated internally. And because of that, my boss can provide data to this set of registers. Okay, so assuming we now say we have another set called maybe A1, A2, B1, C1, and D1. Or I can provide data to registers A1, B1, C1, D1. And then I have program counter 1 and program counter 2. Okay, then I have stack pointer 1 and stack pointer 2. Okay, so this is just to give you a rough idea about why hyperthreading is not considered a full processor, but it's seen as half a processor. So essentially what it means is that the processor can be working on two different sets of data at the same time, and it doesn't have to context switch. If you remember, the operation of a context switch is that the processor will save the contents of the registers onto the stack, save the program counter onto the stack, and load other values into the register and load other value into the program counter and start executing that. And then after a period of time, it moves those data away again and then brings in a fresh one or even goes back to the previous one. So the hyperthreading was very good at avoiding context switching when we have to run two applications concurrently, because it didn't need to save data onto the stack, but it still had one arithmetic logic unit and one control unit. Okay, so there always has to be this time slicing operation. Yeah, is that clear? I hope. Okay, so we have people also shutting down because of phones. So maybe what we can do is probably to take a break here, and then tomorrow we'll continue from Core 2 Duo. And I don't know if there are any questions so far.
Sorry, sir. From the diagram I see on the microprocessor evolution, the Disco i7, which have 4 cores, you just removed the...
Yeah, 4 cores and 8 threads.
Yeah, I was trying to ask a question depending on that slide, which I've got diagram of microprocessor evolution. So my question was, it is Core i7, but there is written as 4 cores. And how come this i7, i5, where does it come from?
Okay, that's a very interesting question. It's really just a gimmick. i7 does not have 7 cores, unfortunately. Okay. We will probably expatiate on this later on. But the truth is, an i5 has 2 cores, okay? But, and then if you look at the fact that with hyperthreading enabled, you have 4 threads. Okay, so it's just a marketing gimmick on the part of Intel. Maybe we can tomorrow, or maybe in a subsequent class, we can look at some data sheets for processors. And I'll show you exactly what Intel says about all of them. So the i7 doesn't really mean it has 7 cores. Nope. It was just all about marketing, getting you to think it has 7 cores, but it doesn't mean, at least not the models you find in your laptops, nor your regular desktops. Okay.
Okay, sir. And another question, I remember earlier we were talking about this data type, whereby I answered like the 64-bit is performing faster. Yes. Then it was cleared like it has to be the one with the lower number of bits. Yes. So my question is, since for the case of this kind of operating system or other program, which we normally use in our systems, they are used for 64-bit and 32-bit. So it means that the one which is telling you is for 32-bit performs faster than the one with the 4, or there is the other way around?
Okay. Interestingly enough, usually what Intel also did with these processors was to increase the operating frequency. Okay. So because we're increasing the operating frequency, we get a boost in performance. Okay, so generally, you see, that's why our original concept said working faster and harder. So by increasing the operating frequency, I'm making the processor to work harder, to work faster. By increasing the size of the bus or the data bus, I'm making it work harder. Okay. A 64-bit processor compared to most 32-bit processors typically did not go beyond maybe 1 to 2 gigahertz. But I think 64-bit processors were approaching things like 4 gigahertz, 3 to 4 gigahertz, and stuff like that. Okay.
Okay, sir. Thank you.
Okay, if you want more details about this, I think we can probably cover, because there are more the engineering side of things, and we can cover some of them in a different class.
Okay, sir.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Are there any other questions? Okay.
No, sir.
Yeah. Okay, I guess that was a no, or was that hello? Somebody had a question? Let me stop sharing. Okay. I understand that it's a no. Okay. So probably we'll meet again tomorrow. And enjoy the rest of your day. Okay. And I think we can discuss the homework tomorrow.
All right. Thank you very much.
To have you today. I see one of your colleagues has already left. Okay, so thank you. See you tomorrow.
All right, bye-bye, sir.
All right, sir.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, bye.